Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMel with you with the positive mind. Here we are in a new year. Bringing new ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Exciting day today. Exciting. Exciting year coming up. But part of what we get confronted with at this time of year is a friend of mine's a nurse over at the hospital. And she's in an emergency ward, and she was telling me about how many deaths had come by and how many people had to deal with death itself. And then coincidentally, I ran into two good friends, Linda Vanella, who has been working as a death grief counselor in the Archdiocese of Rockville Center, meaning she worked for a church for 30 years, doing groups for people who are grieving. And I run into Nicole Alston. Now, Nicole Alston is no ordinary person also. And she has quite a story, but also founded and became part of and works with another group. What's the name of the group, Nicole?
Complicated.
Oops, I'm sorry, Nicole. Do that again.
Complicated Grief Treatment Project.
The Complicated Grief Treatment Process.
Project.
Let's talk about this for a minute. Grief itself. You know, we all have death in our lives. The younger you are, the less there is. I asked Lauren Sykes, who is my assistant here at the station, when we put things together, how many people does she know who died? Lauren, what was your response? Do you remember?
Yeah, basically, you know, no one that I see on a daily basis has passed yet. The closest person that has gone on is my grandmother, and she lived, you know, states away. So I would probably see her maybe, you know, once to twice a year. So I can't even imagine, you know, losing someone, you know, that's primarily in my life.
Well, that's kind of an interesting thing. How old are you, Lauren?
I'm 23.
23 years old. I can't imagine someone dying. I can't imagine it. Now, the rest of you, who are not 23, you can't imagine because you've all gone through it in one form or another. And some of you have gone through it personally, and some of you have been with people who have gone through it. So dealing with it, believe it or not, is a skill. A while back, someone discovered these five stages. Let me see, Lauren, what are the five stages of grieving?
So the first stage would be denial and isolation. The second would be anger. The third is bargaining. Fourth is depression. And the last stage is acceptance.
This was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross said, you know, there are five stages to go through. And if you don't go through all five, you're going to suffer. Now, you're going to suffer means prolonged grief. And that's what we want to avoid. Why do we want to avoid prolonged grief? Because, my friends, you cannot afford to have prolonged grief. Because if you're grieving, you probably loved someone. And if you loved someone, then that means you have the capacity to love. And if you have the capacity to love, I need you on my team. There's not very many of us out here. Now, those of you who could have somebody die and not feel anything, I don't need you on my team. I need the ones on the team who do feel things. So maybe you're going through a prolonged grief and don't even know it. So let's step into this a little bit and find out what we do and what we could do that may be helpful to you, that may help you get through this a little bit. Now, I know, for example, Linda, you worked with prolonged grief, right?
Yes, I have.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Okay, yes, I have worked with complicated grief among parents who have lost a child. And I worked extensively with people who've lost a spouse, as well as those who have lost someone, be it a child or be it an adult in their life, and found that the complications of grief stay with people and create much havoc and ill health and perhaps even suicide. So I have really devoted myself to holding many groups and have done much individual work with people who are grieving. I would like to talk about that, if I may. The person, usually the person is kept alive in the recesses of the unconscious. And the parent who's lost the child suffers depression because they are internally fighting to keep the child alive by suppressing the reality of the death. So the object of the groups that I had run, usually about 6 weeks, would allow the parent to move the child from the recesses of the brain, the unconscious, to the forefront of the brain, the conscious.
Very interesting. Let me think about that for a minute. Now, you're talking about groups specifically for parents who lost children.
Yes, I am.
And in those groups, the children, the part of the reason that the parent doesn't really get over the grieving is because they're keeping the kid alive in the recess of their mind. You don't want to keep the kid alive in the forefront of your mind because that's too active. It makes you feel bad.
Exactly.
So you're keeping them in the back of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. And so now what you do is you bring them up front.
Exactly. And by doing so, by bringing the child alive again, the group members played with each other's member's child for a short while. The parent were able to bond together. The parent is encouraged to bring in joyful memories. The therapist encourages the group to imagine hearing and seeing the lost child. This is done because visualizing is part of the frontal lobe functioning of the brain. It brings it forward in another opportunity to feel the pain that they're suffering with, the sensations of it. They become alive again. So therefore, it's but by reliving the joyful, it also activates the reality that these experiences will not happen again. So once again, we're going into the reality that this is a loss that's very real and that it's significant. So it allows the parent once again to bring it forward and to feel, and that's the objective of this counseling. It's to allow people the opportunity to feel.
So these groups that you would have, people would get together and they would talk about some of the wonderful times they had with their child who was dead.
Exactly.
Right? Mm-hmm. And then they would talk about the wonderful times. But by talking about the wonderful times, they're not talking as if the child is alive. They're saying, here's my beautiful memory. And they would share these memories with each other, as I've heard about your groups.
Yes.
But at the same time as they're sharing them, they're also sharing, I lost my child.
Exactly.
So you have the present.
Mm-hmm.
Is bringing the present rather than just holding on to the past.
Exactly.
It's a fascinating process because I know it works. I've known people who have done it with you.
There is joy and pain and present together rather than separated by the denial and the unconscious. And whether it be a lost child or a mate, it's like losing a part of yourself. And therefore, the group members can act as a transition family. They help the wound begin healing. It never does heal, we know that. It remains an open sore that you live with, but not one that dominates your life. And that's where we go into complicated grief.
Dominates your life is when you fall out.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much.
Most welcome.
I often wonder, what's the proper way to go through it? You know, I mean, let's think about it. I don't mean to just do disparaging on the Irish, but the Irish drink. Alcohol comes out, and you're at a wake, and people are dead drunk. Now, I know that alcohol has one primary characteristic. It inhibits memory. Now, this may be a way of saying, I'm going to forget that you died. And what I'm going to do is inhibit the memory of your death by drinking. And so we get drunk, and we inhibit this memory. And then when you go over their house and you open the closet, they say, oh, don't open that. It's Daddy's closet. Or that's Mommy's drawer. That's where I keep Mommy, you know. That's where I keep Daddy. And I think a lot of that has to do with the very process. And then it goes further than that. Because there goes to where you could have drinking, and then my favorite way of having of dealing with death comes from something like this, which is what I want you to do at my grave, friends. picture a group of people dancing down the streets, singing in memory of... Well, it brings me to the subject of complicated grief. Because complicated grief is the pain that does not go away.
That's right. We're talking about death and grief today. Because 2.5 million deaths occur annually in the United States. And each of those deaths are on affect four other people on average.
Four other people on average, you meaning? Like if somebody dies, a husband dies, you got kids, you got wives.
Right, siblings, aunts, uncles, family, friends.
I'd say it's five other people. Because you got the guy who died too, it affects him.
That's true. That's true.
But of course people get over it. Right? What happens?
Well, at some point, with what we call normal grief, people are able to integrate the death and to put it in a place that they can understand. They can kind of, it doesn't dominate their lives, as Linda says.
And what happens when it doesn't go into a normal place? Now, what is prolonged grief?
Prolonged grief, the intense reactions, the yearning, the sadness, those acute feelings, they keep going on, and it can last 20, 30, 40 years. It can feel like the death occurred yesterday.
And it's almost like you died when they died.
That's it.
You know, maybe that's part of it, going along with that. That you're kind of going along with the death.
Right.
Now, this is, you run an institute, or you started an institute.
A foundation, yes.
What about your foundation?
I started a foundation. The name of it is the Sky Foundation. And we are the link between bereaved parents coping or dealing with pregnancy loss or infant death and the medical community to help understand, bridge the gap of understanding between both parties.
Nicole, I would love to be able to talk about this theoretically, but you have about the most profound experience that a mental health professional, as you are, would be able to communicate with the knowledge and wherewithal that you have. Do you mind telling us what happened with you?
Not at all, Armand. It was in 2005, and it was on my due date.
Due date meaning when you were having a baby.
Right, of my firstborn. And I thought that everything was going to be okay. My doctor told me that we were on autopilot and went to the hospital expecting the best day of my life, only to find out that my daughter no longer had a heartbeat. So she was stillborn. Her name was Sky. A couple of hours later.
What did that do to you?
It was... I found that I just checked out of life. I checked out. My joy was completely gone. I can remember avoiding people, places, and things that reminded me of the pregnancy, reminded me of anything having to do with Sky. And I was talking to someone a few days ago, and it was, I described it as my eyes were there, but there was nothing in the socket.
How long did you go on that way?
I would say that I went on like that for about a year and a half, 2 years.
2 years? They couldn't budge you?
No.
What were you like? Were you hiding out?
I was definitely hiding out. Because you're going back, if you're going back to the grocery store, people are saying, where's the baby? Going to the gym, where's the baby? People are asking questions, so I finally just found it easier to hide out. And people didn't see me. I disconnected from quite a few friends. I wasn't talking to anyone, really.
And you had nothing to give? What if you had died, would that have been okay?
It would have been completely fine.
It would have been like a gift.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Common feeling. I often wonder what happens to older people. You know, they're 70 years old or 80 years old and you lose your partner, and then just 3 months later they die. I think there's a will that you get. You know, you just say, I don't want to be here anymore. Let me be with them. So then you did some work on yourself to kind of make that turnabout. What did you do?
I went on a spiritual fast, a series of 21-day partial fasts. And I found from those fasts that I began to turn the corner. I was given direction as to what to do with my life, and it really changed my life, the focus of my life's work.
The focus of your life work was to now help people go through grieving?
Yes, broadly, but initially it was specifically to help people who have experienced pregnancy loss. And out of that, I produced a documentary on infant death from the African-American perspective.
You did produce it?
Yes.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
I'd love to show it to you.
Great. From the African-American community experiencing the loss of a child, what is the, do you know what the rate of death among the African-American community is of newborns?
Yes. African-Americans are 2 to 3 times as likely to experience a poor birth outcome.
Hmm. And there's not that many resources.
There are some. I mean, there are resources. I hadn't found any films done in 2006 when I did it.
Okay, so now you do that, and you're doing that for a while. And then it's almost as if they were testing you. You had another trauma of a similar kind. What happened?
Yes, my sister's stepdaughter, my brother-in-law's daughter, my niece died. She was murdered in a triple homicide.
A triple homicide in New Jersey?
Yes.
How did that happen?
She was shot and killed, and with 2 other people in the house.
She was shot and killed, and two other people in the house.
Right, and she was 15.
And you were close to her as well, I'm sure.
She called me her favorite, one of her favorites. She spent some time at our house, and I think also just what that brought up for me.
What did it bring up for you?
Losing a daughter, and the fact that, you know, forever, you know, I remember, you're always thinking of what might have been, and I would imagine that my brother-in-law and sister and her mom and family members are always thinking of what might have been.
So that was a second giant test. Did you handle that differently than you did the first? Because now you had all this knowledge and information.
Right. It was a completely different situation because it was a violent death. So watching people close to me experience that, and you've talked about on your show, the ghost child. She had 2 siblings younger than her. She was, and it's just the anger it brings up, bitterness, hopelessness.
Nobody understands the anger that goes along with death. You know, if someone dies, one of the worst things that happen is we begin to feel angry. And we feel angry, and it doesn't make any sense. Here, your mother dies, right? How could you get angry at your mother? What are you going to say? Why didn't you take better care of yourself? But what happens to the inner child, the child inside us, is that we say to ourselves, how could you leave me? And you get angry at the person for leaving you. Now, that doesn't, of course, make sense, and you couldn't say it to anybody. What Kubler-Ross learned is that that was the magic, that if you could touch that anger, the person gets relieved. But if they can't touch it, if they glorify their parent, if they say she was a saint, if they say, I mean, that's a likely thing to do, and that's the way most people would feel. But they say, find the resentment, find the anger. The majority of people I know who do not find that anger, do you know what they do? They get divorces. They turn the anger against their spouse. And suddenly, and I knew one man whose mother died and he got divorced 2 days later. 2 days later, he says, I want out of this marriage. You couldn't talk him into it. Because the anger that he felt was so unallowed, not allowed, that he had to take it somewhere else. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're talking about a heavy subject here, grief. But I want to talk about grief, and I want to talk about it with these four wonderful people here. The idea of it is that I want you not to be grieving a complicated grief. I want to introduce words into our language like death. Instead of passed on, left, what are the words do they use? What are the words we use to moved on? Yeah. Made a transition. You know, and died. My friend Richie died. My friend Richie was my closest friend. And he died of leukemia suddenly. It made no sense that Richie, the health nut, Richie, the guy who worked out every day, Richie, the guy who wouldn't touch a piece of meat, got leukemia and died. Made no sense to me whatsoever. I got so angry at Richard. So angry at him for being healthy and leaving. And leaving me. Leaving me as his best friend. That it saved me. I had another time when I had two people die simultaneously. One best friend and my mother. And I remember I was smart enough to grieve my mother. But I was grieving her and I was letting myself cry. I was feeling sad. In fact, I was at her casket, and I was crying. I was young, and my uncle came along, and he said, "Now, Armand, you're going to have to take care of everybody." And I turned over and looked at him, and I said, "You take care of everybody. I'm crying. This is your sister. Shouldn't you be crying, too?" But then following that, a week later, my other best friend died in an accident. And everybody came to me and said, "You know, we have to make arrangements." And I said, "I'm sorry. I can't do it." He had called this priest, tell him to just repeat what I just did for my mother. And they just had a repeat performance. But going through it with people is rough. As people get older, they go through it with more and more people. Then there comes this issue of facing your own death. Of facing it, looking at it and saying, "Okay, here it comes." There was a man I knew who was living next door to me. He was dying, and nobody talked to him about his death. Nobody talked to him. So I went over, he was a good friend. And I went over to his house, and everybody was talking about, "You're going to get better, you're going to get better." But you looked at him, and he was on his way out. And I said to him, "Richard, how do you feel about dying?" And he was aghast. I should say such a thing. I said, "I think you're dying, Richie. Is there anything you feel about it? Is there anything you want to know? Is there anything you want me to take care of?" This was a different Richard. Two Richards died, both good friends. Never name anybody Richard. No, it was just those two. Anyway, Richard turned to me, and he talked to me about it. Then his son, who heard what I said, got so angry at me. "How could you talk to Dad about his dying?" But later, Dad said it was the biggest relief to have been able to speak about it. Speaking about death, your own death, is fabulous. You know, when everybody tells you not to mention it, that's a good thing. But when people have someone who dies, and they have people like you two, Linda and Nicole, who they could deal with to get help, that's amazing. It's an amazing thing. People get deeply depressed. They experience the world as gray. They get stuck in a pace of pain and grief. Here are the symptoms of complicated grief. You miss your loved one all the time. You have difficulty accepting that they're gone. You're avoiding things that remind you that your loved one is gone. You have frequent memories, thoughts, or images. And it's constant. It's over and over again. Well, this is a new year, my friends. Maybe it's time to do something about this, to come out into the daylight, to find the way. If you can't deal with it yourself, let us find you some of the resources that'll help you with it. And we'll find you some of the things. Now, tell me about the organization that you founded.
Well, the Complicated Grief Treatment Project is a research study that I'm working with as the community liaison.
And that's current.
That's current, yes.
And that's up at Columbia?
That's at Columbia.
And at Columbia what?
Columbia University.
Okay.
Yes. And so that is where the research is taking place.
So how do people get in touch with them? Is there a phone number at Columbia, or you just call Columbia University and say, I want death. What do you do?
Yes, there's a phone number, Armand. It's 212-851-2107.
2107 up at Columbia University.
That's correct.
Complicated Grief Study Program.
That's correct.
What happens there?
We are looking at comparing two different types of treatment for complicated grief. One of those treatments is traditional interpersonal therapy, and the other one is complicated grief treatment therapy. So you won't know if you're eligible to participate. You won't know which treatment you're part of the treatment you're getting. But for individuals who are 60 and over, particularly, they can call and be phone screened and see if they can be eligible for the study.
And there's no drugs or any of that involved?
We have two studies going on, and the one for complicated grief treatment for older adults, there are no drugs.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like an interesting thing to do. Other things, Linda, how would people, if they were out on the island, they would get in touch with who that you know of?
It would be under family ministry, under the Diocese of Rockville Center. They can call the diocese in Rockville Center, and they could give them some information. It's all throughout Nassau and Suffolk, and I know we have them here in the five boroughs of Manhattan as well. So there are groups available, and it would be under the umbrella of parish social ministry, as I did out in Port Jefferson under the diocese.
So sometimes you want to do it individually also. Both of you, I know, are available for individual counseling as well, but it's not what you're selling. You're saying, you know, try the group process, but sometimes you need individual help. When do you need individual help?
I believe that my seeing people individually is truly much more effective because I know all the variables and I'm not mixing my own emotional needs with the client's emotional needs. I am completely at their service. However, in a group, everyone needs to be served. So being able to balance the needs becomes a priority of the time spent together. But in certain settings, like where I worked as social worker in the Diocese of Rockville Center, my available time for individual work was limited. Now when I work here in New York, I find it virtually impossible to coordinate people's schedules. So although at times a group would be ideal, I find it difficult to put together. However, if we do receive 6 committed responses to today's program, I'm hoping that we will try to make it happen right here.
Wow, and here at the DeMel Center as well. Our telephone number here today is 212-209-2900. We're going to play a little music for you. In fact, I think I'll play you a little funeral music from down south because it's so beautiful from Preservation Hall. And when we come back, we'll take your calls at 212-209-2900. My guests, Nicole and Linda, and we're just kicking it. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Ah, such fine, fine music. Preservation Hall, my friends. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here at WBAI 99.5 FM. One of the things that happened the most around the holidays is we in the mental health profession have to deal with death a lot. And mostly we deal with suicides. And suicide is just a thing that happens because people look around, they get lonely, they miss the ones who are gone, and they decide to exit. Now, what do I think of suicide? You know, I mean, it's your life. You can do what you want with it, but boy, I resent taking out the good ones. So since death becomes such an active part of this time of year, I decided to bring you a program about talking about it just a little more actively. Now, let's talk, just go a step further with what is, you mentioned the ghost children. What is a ghost child?
I think of it in terms of subsequent child, the child that's born after the child that died. And I can
They call it the ghost child.
Right.
Because?
They call it the ghost child because it's the child that's not here, perhaps even not talked about, but the child still exists.
So if you learn from your parents that there was a child before you that died, how does that affect you? How does that affect their treatment of you if you don't learn about that right away, but you learn about it later? You mean all that while you were treating me like something, I was a second child, and I thought I was a first child.
Right, right. You'll find that parents overcompensate. They can become overprotective. You can also find that parents may have difficulty even connecting with that subsequent child. I interviewed someone on the documentary who had a stillbirth at 14, and she went on to have, I believe, not one or two more children on the same date, born on the same date as the child who was stillborn.
Wow.
Yes.
So that made it even rougher.
Right. So on that birthday, in August, she has a cake, and she cuts it, she has it sectioned off for three different names.
212-209-2900. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you.
Hi there.
Hi, Marissa here. How are you?
Hello, Marissa. Nice to hear from you.
Thank you. You know, I just want to say that when my mother was dying back in 2001, she died from a misdiagnosis from a doctor, unfortunately. You know, early detection in cancer is key. And I was devastated because, you know, my mother was almost 80, but you don't really picture them dead because basically I wasn't raised in a culture where death is acceptable. At the time my mother was dying, I took a class at the Open Center on Dreams with a psychologist, and her mother was coincidentally dying in California. So then they both died like 2 days apart, ironically, and, you know, I was distraught, I was emaciated, you know, I went through a lot after my mother died, not to mention seeing her die. And then I resumed my class because I don't want to miss it, and it just shows how people are so different. The psychologist looked great. She looked like she came from a vacation in California, and she said that it was a beautiful experience. And I screamed at her, and I said, "What's wrong with you? Your mother just died." She said, "Yes, it was so beautiful." You know, and at the time, I felt like she's disgusting. You know, how dare she say something like that? But, you know, basically, I think she's probably better off.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. But there are people I know who have taken people through transitions in such a way that they stayed so close right to the end. Of course, she was running a workshop, but I have seen people do that. They take death and they just glorify the passage.
And it was beautiful.
It works.
You know, I'd rather be like her, frankly.
Yeah.
But it's just amazing because, you know, some cultures teach you to celebrate death, that it's a natural passage and that it's great. But look how screwed up we are here. We're not taught that. We grieve, we get sick over it, people go on medication, all kinds of crazy things happen. you know, because we're taught that if you die, it's horrible. But the truth is, we're all going to die. You know, eat well, live well, die anyway. Like your friend with the health food.
Absolutely. I thank you for calling in.
You're welcome.
212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. What an interesting thing. You know, nobody wants to hear about death. They said every time we have a program, started a program on death, everybody hung up. Who wants to hear about that? When you're a kid, it's the last thing in your mind. You don't think about it. You think about it as you get older, though. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Armand. I'm a person who unfortunately suffered a lot of death experiences. My entire family was wiped out by the time I was in my mid-20s, and I also lost my first child. And one thing that I do, for example, today is a very bad day because I have to sell off assets. And I lit a candle, and I thank God for the fact that I have two living children, and these assets can be replaced, and they're just junk. But the thing was, in my case, I was an unwanted child, and an abused and a beaten, you know, and nearly killed, and lost my hearing, and so forth, on one ear. And what I grieve, okay, is not the death of my mother, the untimely death, but the fact that I was never able, as hard as I tried, to communicate and have a relationship.
Yeah,
I grieve that. And I have these fantasies, and I can't do it because I want to be a mature person. But I think about... I'm sorry, I have...
They don't want you to talk about it.
I have macaws. I
know. You hear the macaws?
Yeah.
They hear you talking about ending your life, and they're barking at you. Don't you talk about that, Mama.
You misunderstand me. I think about taking my mother's gravestone and beating it with a sledgehammer or actually urinating on her grave.
Uh-huh. Sure.
You know, there's so much anger. But this, please let me make one other point.
Sure.
I got to spend a lot of time in China. My daughter went there to live, and she's, you know, been teaching there 4 years. They have such little disregard that they'll harm their baby and carry around a dead baby as a begging tool. They'll have sales on abortion, 2-for-1 day, half-price day.
All right, that's enough. That's enough. That's all the images that I want to put in people's minds. Thank you. I do hear. But you, my friend, you are one brave lady, and you got a bunch of macaws who certainly must make your neighbors crazy, and they sound like good friends. I thank you for calling in. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille. Hello there.
Hi.
Hiya.
Hello. I don't know whether I'll be able to get through this.
Yeah, through. Oh, through.
So,
try your best. I'm
I may just plain hang up.
All right. Instead, if it's just about crying, then you could cry instead of hanging up.
I don't cry.
Oh, that may be the problem.
I know.
But you're about to now.
That's why I'd hang up.
All right. Now wait. Let's stop a second. Tears are the sweat of the heart. You see, when your heart breaks open, cracks open, and is ready to get free, that's when the tears come. So I'm with you. You want to hang up, you hang up. You want to cry with me, you cry with me. Tell me a story.
I'm over 60. Right after I graduated from college... man I was going to marry died.
Mm.
I cried. I guess that was the last time I really cried about... No, that's not true. Uh,
Keep going. What's your name?
No.
No is your name?
Listen, I'll tell you, it's Edgar.
Your name? Your name is Edgar?
That's good enough.
Okay, Edgar.
I had no idea what to do. Like I said, I knew the moment he died because a friend brought me to her house. He was in the hospital. And all of a sudden, I started screaming like a maniac.
It was
about 12:02 in the morning, a.m., right after midnight. She gets a phone call from her boyfriend, and he had been at the hospital, and he told her he just died.
Now you've been holding this in, and you've been suffering for how many years now?
Well, over 40.
40 years. And you know that there's some piece of you that is holding on to it for dear life. There's a piece of you that's holding on to it, and there's a part of you that is dying to live again, right?
That's a little too late for that.
Well, I'm not so sure, because what we just heard about the project that they're working on up in Columbia are the people who refuse to make it too late for that. Would you at least take a look at it?
I guess so, because I can't say much more.
Yeah, well, I appreciate what you are saying. Let me give you the phone number again, okay?
Yeah.
Would you write it down?
Yeah.
Phone number again. Here we go.
The phone number is 212-851-2107.
Hey, Edgar, let me ask you something.
Yeah.
What part of you, was it you who called out, or was it the man who you were going to marry who called me?
Oh, I don't know. I don't do that. I could have picked Winifred or something.
I know, but who called me? Was it you calling me, or was it him calling me saying, please free my woman?
I don't know.
Maybe. Oh, good. Yeah, I think that happens. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. Let's take another call, and let's hope Edgar or Winifred gets where she has to go. 212-209-2900, Armand DeMille, let me take another call. Hi there.
Hi, Armand, how are you?
Good.
Good. I'm in town from the South on business and happened to catch your show on the radio. And I just wanted to briefly tell you about my father's passing.
Yes, tell me.
Okay,
your father's dying?
Yeah, that's right. That's correct. I was 30 years old. He was 57. My father was a physician, very rigorous, big man, 6'4", 260 pounds, great sense of humor. And at the time when he died, it was his liver was failing and he went into renal failure and got the septicemia, and he knew he was dying. He was a physician. I knew he was dying. I'm the oldest of five children, and, you know, it was really difficult and painful and hard, but I'm listening to these people that are having such a difficult time, and I guess I was lucky that I'm able now to put my father's passing into perspective as part of his life, not the definitive moment in his life, but a part of it, right?
A part of his life.
That's right. So it's a natural progression for me, and I don't know if I'm lucky that my parents, by kidding around and talking about, you know, we're all going to die at some point. I don't mean this to be insensitive to people who can't understand this, but at the time, you know, it was really difficult at 30 years old. I'm 20 years older now, and I choose to remember my father when I was a young boy, when I was a teenager, when I was a young man doing stupid things, and as I got older, and I don't really miss him, I'm sorry, but I'm able to position it that he had this entire life, and his death, and when he died, he was so thin and emaciated and horrible, not the death that he wanted ever. And we actually kind of kidded around about it. You know, he never wanted to pass the way he did, But I'm lucky. I'm able to put it in a position that that's not who my dad was. That's a piece of his life, right? But that wasn't it.
Well, what's your name? What's your name?
My name's Craig.
Craig. So, yeah, I think you're right. That's kind of a normal response. And you had a support team around you. But for many people, they don't have that. 15% of the people suffer silently and privately.
I've heard so many of the people calling in, and I just feel terrible for them that like I said, I may have been lucky that my family was kind of larger, and we were able to kind of, not in an insensitive way, but we kind of teased each other a lot. And, you know, I know I'm going to die. My daughters know I'm going to die. And, you know, you're talking to me. You know I'm going to die. Well, it's all inevitable, and it's just, it's one of those things that, you know, I'm not going to get into whole faith-based stuff and everything else, but you have this infrastructure and these people. And I think it's, I wish these folks are able to move on, and I think that Columbia number might be able to help them. But anyway, I just want to call you. I've enjoyed your show, and I appreciate it so much.
Craig, thanks for listening in.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can always hear us on the internet by where you are down south.
The internet makes it to where I live, so we'll get it.
Thank you.
212. Yes, sir.
Bye-bye. 212-209-2900. I'm on Craig's list. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello.
Hello.
My name is Bob. I'm on.
Hello, Bob.
How you doing? I was in a fortunate position. I guess it was fortunate to see, to be around a lot of the people I loved when they died. Some of them are wonderful. Some of them not so wonderful.
The people or the death?
The people and the deaths. And I look them in the eyes, and I try to hold their hand to make their journey a little easier. I heard a story today that sheds a little light in some weird way. A guy, this is a true story, a guy got out off the plane today, and he had a package, and they made him open the package. And it was a cooked rabbit, right?
No, it was cocaine. No, he said it was a cooked rabbit.
No, listen.
Uh-huh.
He opens it up, and it was a cooked rabbit. So they opened the rabbit, and it was full of cocaine.
Okay.
I mean, I know the bottom line. It was full of cocaine. So one of the security guys says, "Now your rabbit is really cooked."
Oh, that was cute.
That was funny.
That was a cute thing. Now your rabbit is really cooked,
and he's going to remember that ride for the next few years.
You know, I imagine one thing, Bob.
Yeah.
You've held the hand of people who have died.
Yeah.
And you kind of saw them when the lights went out.
Yeah.
What's that like, Bob?
Oh.
I've done it twice.
You've done it twice. It's beautiful, and it's enriching, and it's very sad. And,
beautifully sad.
All at the same time, and... But it's a privilege, too, I think, in a way. It's a privilege. I became like I lived a very crazy life, and I've been a death master. I've been with a lot of people that were, some were killed, some died naturally, and I saw them off, you know? So, in a way, I'm a death master.
Mm-hmm.
Although that's not that doesn't put me on the head of any list or anything.
Yeah, but in a way, you talked about the privilege of it. And I think you know that when we are allowed to have that last moment with somebody, we feel the voyage. There's a piece of us that travels on that edge.
Yeah.
And it's quite a privilege.
Yeah.
And so many people are afraid to be there.
Yes, that's a big part of it, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're the kind of guy who it would be helpful to a lot of people to have around, you know?
I am helpful in a lot of different ways, but I'm a crazy package, but I can be helpful if I wish.
I'm sure you are. Thanks for calling in, Bob.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Bye. Imagine Bob among the rest of us. That's why I want you people to wake up. See, I want you to wake up because I need you, Bobs. I need you people to join us. You know, here we are at WBAI. What are we doing here? We're trying to bring you information, programs about health, about life, about death. about being. There's a lot of people I know who care. Honestly, really care. They're not just sellers. They're people who care. And it's so nice to find them in the world. Hey, we're going to be leaving you shortly. And we will be back with you tomorrow, Wednesday, at 1 p.m. I know it's confusing, my friends, but it's most Wednesdays, every Tuesdays. And on Thursdays, we send you something on the internet, in Facebook. If you're looking for a program to listen to, I like to do 15-minute programs on Facebook to fill in the time. Until the day comes when everything gets straightened out. I'll be back with you on tomorrow at 1 p.m. Special thanks to Michael G. Haskins, Linda Vanella, Nicole, thank you so much for being here, and Lauren Sykes, of course. We will be back with you tomorrow, my friends, at 1 p.m.